today we're here with Warren Farrell, who is a pretty well-known author and is here to discuss some of his work over the years, particularly around the topic of feminism. So, Warren, thanks for joining us.
I'm looking forward to it, Adrian.
So can you tell me, you're one of the pioneers of second wave feminism.
I guess that's true. Yeah, my history with feminism began in the 70s. I was doing my doctorate in political science at New York University in the early 70s, and the women's movement surfaced. Actually, this was the late 60s, and it just took an interest in me. And my former wife and I, you know, went to some of the rallies, and she said, "Warren, please stay out of this. There's a lot of man-hating here that runs deep inside of this this early part of the feminist movement." And I said, "Yeah, I see that, but I also see that they are really encouraging a reduction of stereotyped roles, and I think that we really do need to move from rigid roles. Men and women have a lot more flexibility than than society has sort of allowed them to do." And so we went back and forth on that. And you know, one day she said to me, "You know, I see that when you are talking about these issues, there's a fire in your belly that I don't see as much of when you talk about political science or politics in general." And she said, "If you want to go ahead and do that, if that's what your passion is, go for it." And so I said, "Thanks, I really appreciate that." And I did. And so, long story short, I got elected to the board of directors. The people in the National Organization for Women said that they were about, in New York City, which is where we lived, were about to kick men out of NOW in New York City, and it was becoming a big debate in NOW as to whether or not that should be done. And so the New York City NOW negotiated with National NOW that they would try to do something that would incorporate men and see if it worked. And so they asked me if I would start men's groups on the evenings, the Thursday evenings in which they had women's groups once a month. And I did, and those men's groups went really well. And the New York City NOW said, "Okay, we'll keep men in there, and they can be supporters, etc." And in a sense, they're not all evil type of thing. And so then they asked me if I'd run for the board of directors of the National Organization for Women in New York City, the New York City chapter. And so I did, I served the next 3 years on the board of NOW in New York City, and then my former wife became a White House fellow, and we moved to Washington D.C. So I left that position in NOW in New York and moved with her to D.C., where she was a White House fellow under George Shultz under the Nixon administration. Even though we were both Democrats, so it was an interesting experience. And so that was my beginning of the involvement with the feminist movement. I had a wonderful series of experiences there. I remember one,
Actually, just before you go on, had you had any involvement in gender issues before this, or was this just the first time?
First time. It was like 1969, but it was like I went to the first, sort of a radical feminist meeting, which was part of Alternate University in Greenwich Village. And the Alternate University was sort of a socialist type of Marxist sort of oriented university. And I just attended an evening meeting there, and they were very socialist Marxist, which I felt went way too far. But on the other hand, I was, they were the first ones to articulate feminist issues.
Well, you're in college, and that's what one does in college.
Exactly, especially if you're doing your doctorate in political science at New York University.
Right.
you know, Marxism was sort of standard operating procedure, teaching. And so even though I disagreed with significant portions of it at the time, I was enough, in line with it that I sort of, didn't have an inherent adversity to attending something.
How were things back then? So, for example, my mother, she's talked about feminism as being something that's very important that has enabled her to work and have a career. And she's become a successful teacher, and she's the honorary consul for France and Germany in Tasmania, which is where I'm from. And these things probably wouldn't have happened without feminism, or so it seems. Is that the case? I mean, were women's roles really that rigid that they couldn't do anything? I mean, because we had Margaret Thatcher, we had Marie Curie, there's been a lot of women that have been successful, and I mean, not as many as should have been, but I guess I'm confused on that.
Yes, it would have been like saying to a man in the 50s, you know, you saw that he was a gentle young man, and he said, you know what I want to be when I grow up? I want to be a full-time dad. And, you know, it's not that he couldn't have become a full-time dad. He might have found a woman somewhere that would have, you know, accepted and married him and as a full-time dad if he wasn't wealthy. But the chances of that happening, that we have missed the opportunities for millions, probably billions of women with enormous talents to feel so frustrated by being, confined into a narrow dimension of possibilities. And so, you know, if we believe in human beings, it's in all of our self-interest to encourage men to discover the part of themselves that might want to be a full-time dad, and to encourage women to be the part of themselves that might not just be so strong and so powerful that they overcome all the odds and become the Madame Curies or the Margaret Thatchers. But we don't want to make it that difficult so that only 1 in 10,000 survive the process. And so for every Margaret Thatcher and Madame Curie, there were a lot of women who were told by their guidance counselors and told by their mothers, if they were very bright, you know, you could be a teacher. Well, I really am, you know, good at, I love engineering. You know, well, she doesn't even know that she loves engineering because she's only gotten as far as math, and so she can't go into that. But, you know, that could be a future engineer that we were discouraging. And children, when they're young, the great majority of them are discouraged or encouraged relatively easily. And so we do that much, much less with women now, but we're still doing that with men with regard to any desire on a young boy's part to be, you know, a full-time dad, or while he doesn't earn any money, is very rare. I mean, I had my first experience. Go ahead, Adrian, you started to say something.
Yeah. Are you aware of the anthropology research by Margaret Mead?
Sure, yes. I've seen Papua New Guinea.
And I imagine her work was fairly influential on second wave feminism, right?
It was. It was not actually very accurate, as it turns out.
That's exactly what I wanted to ask you, because then, you know, this angry white guy, Derek Friedman in ANU in Australia, went and spent 40 years researching it and found out that, in fact, what Margaret Mead built her career on was not right. And what this fundamentally was about was being able to modify culture in ways that superseded genetics. And Derek Friedman's comment is genetics drives culture and not the other way around.
Margaret was wrong and Friedman was wrong, in my opinion, because what we now know from neuroplasticity and neuroscience teaches us that genes run very deeply and very powerfully, and neuroplasticity research teaches us that culture turns on genes or turns off genes, that we all have enormous genetic potential inside of us that are turned on or turned off by what happens to us in our cultural experiences. And so genes, so when people used to ask me, you know, what is it, nature or nurture? My answer was, yes, it's nature and it's nurture. And they say, well, what do you mean by that? And I say that, you know, nature influences nurture and nurture influences nature. And we now know that that's, you know, much, much more accurate than I believed it was, or anybody believed it was, back when I was saying that in the 70s.
Well, there's a complex interaction between nature and nurture, and the balance is finding which way it goes, and it's going to be different for different things. For some things, it'll be 90% nature and 10% nurture, and for others, it'll be 10% nurture and 90% nature. And
correct. But Adrian, it's extremely important to never let that argument about limit us from examining what we are doing. To discourage, to take that and make a self-fulfilling prophecy out of it. I don't want to say to a son, you know, unbecome what I sense in you are wanting to be, because that's not natural for you. What's natural for him will evolve when I give him permission and freedom to be what he wants to be, but I also have a responsibility as a parent to educate him and her, my daughter and son, as to the trade-offs within the framework of cultural confinements of the time. So, you know, if my daughter in the 1950s wanted to become a Madison Avenue executive, she was going to face barriers that that I needed to educate her about, and at the same time, maybe encourage or discourage her from doing that based on whether or not she had the type of courage it took to overcome those barriers. But my role in the world is taking away the barriers that prevent boys from being whatever they wish to be when they grow up, and preventing girls from being whatever they wish to be when they grow up. And right now, you know, the feminist movement, I think, did an enormous amount of good. However, but the feminist movement has become very much like communism became. It started out liberal, and then it evolved into a bureaucracy that became concerned with political correctness, as it has recently, and in the last 20, 30 years, and human resources and women's studies have only allowed the female perspective. So we no longer have a dialogue between the genders, not that we ever did, but we have, you know, a basically a, not a battle of the sexes, but a war in which only one side has shown up. And as you know, women have been firing the shots and men have been putting their heads in the sand and hoping the bullets would miss. And that is not a dialogue. So what I would like to see is not a women's movement that is demonizing men and undervaluing the family, or a men's movement that's demonizing women and undervaluing their, you know, their potential. But I'd like to see a gender transition movement in which both genders are helping each other, and all facets of society are helping each other move from the rigid roles of the past to more flexible roles in the future, which does not mean that there shouldn't be a reward for people who are firefighters or firefighters or police officers or first responders or warriors who are invariably likely to be more likely to be men than women, but at the same time.
So Warren, I want to jump in. I'm sorry, I want to circle
sure,
back
no,
to
no problem.
Some of the things we were talking about. One of the things that I've been looking at in terms of empathy is that empathy is both a feeling and then it's also based around truth. And I'll give you an example. Let's say that you're a school teacher and you have a kid in one of your classes who's misbehaving a lot. You put up with it a lot, he's disrupting the class, and then finally you start punishing him in some way, or you're sending him to the headmaster or whatever because, you know, you need to get him under control. And then that can be very frustrating. If you later find out that kid is actually being beaten by his parents every day and is in a really terrible home environment, that can change your perspective on the situation. You learn both the reality of what you're feeling and then also some base underlying truth. I very strongly agree with being able to be anything you can be. There are also fundamental genetic foundations which underlie all of this stuff. And this left and right is really important, I think, for understanding concepts like empathy. And it's sort of a simple concept that we have just in a democracy, is this balance between left and right and moving back and forth between those. The reason I bring this up is because I think that the understanding of genetics that we have today, firstly, a lot of it is missing, because in academia is left-wing, and so topics around race and gender are not allowed to be researched. Jonathan Haidt from your alma mater at NYU has done quite a lot of research into this. And so I think we're not getting the full story because they don't want to disrupt the feminist revolution, and I'm curious as to your thoughts on this.
Yeah, there's a lot of truth in what you're saying, and so let's look at, for example, empathy. The traditional liberal perspective very frequently, and you see this with many. I remember when I was in high school, and back in 1960s, early 60s, late 50s, and my guidance counselor said, the kids that are almost always the rowdiest, least disciplined kids in school are the children of the psychologists and psychiatrists. And I said, well, why is that? And he said, I don't know. I think that they have so much empathy for their kids that they don't know how to, they don't set any boundaries for them. And I have found that overall to be true. That is, the left tends to be very understanding of any and tolerant, and that's the good news. The bad news is that they haven't learned what the right has learned, which is that boundary enforcement is extremely important. So take the example of the child that you mentioned in school. You say, you know, it's important to know that his parents beat him, and maybe they had a divorce, and maybe he comes from that background. That informs the way you deal with him and the heart that opens up inside of you toward him. At the same time, the very best thing you can do for him is enforce boundaries, because he will not have that at home. The single most important thing that the left needs to understand about child development is that, you know, that children, that the most important single additive to child development, ingredient in child development, is the importance of a boy knowing how to have postponed gratification. So if a dad says to a boy, or a child says to a boy, especially in divorce, typically speaking, a dad and mom in divorce situation, a child will be told by both parents the exact same thing. You can't have your ice cream, let's say, until you finish your peas. And the boy will do the exact same thing, or the girl will do the exact same thing. You know, they'll try to finish a couple of peas and say, okay, now can I have my ice cream? And the mom and dad will then tend to act differently. The mom in a divorce situation will often feel guilty and fear that the child does not want to take those few special moments while they're eating and make it into a big argument over a few peas. And the mom will tend to give in and say, okay, sweetheart, I understand it's been a tough day. Be very empathetic and say, you know, okay, you can have your ice cream now. And the dad will tend to say, excuse me, we had a deal here. The deal was you can't have your ice cream until you finish your peas. And the child will go, well, you're so mean. Mommy always lets me have my ice cream, you know, without finishing always the peas. Why are you always so mean? And dad will say, well, you can continue whining. And if you continue whining, you'll be no ice cream tomorrow night either, no matter what you do. And then the child gets the point eventually that with dad, there's no manipulating a better deal. Therefore, I have to focus my energy on finishing the peas, that is finishing what I have to do in order to get what I want, the ice cream. With the mother, the child learns, there's a better deal here. There's a better deal to be had here if I just cry and manipulate and get my mother to focus on the fact that I've had a bad day, or that I'm feeling a missing dad.
So you're agreeing with my point on the importance of left and right, effectively.
Exactly. I'm agreeing that the left goes too far toward empathy and doesn't see, as a rule, the value of boundary enforcement. And I also agree that that oftentimes the right goes too far to only thinking about boundary enforcement and feeling that they can't have empathy and get into emotionally understanding what's bothering somebody and do that with boundary enforcement. And the left and the right need to learn from each other. Right. What the left has done, that's a big mistake in the universities, is they've cut out dialogue. They've turned it into a monologue. They've turned it into people who are taking the genetic perspective or the male perspective. They've turned them into devils. Right. They've undervalued the family.
Are you familiar with the book called Antifragile?
I have only heard of it. I have not read it.
So you may want to look at it. One of the concepts of antifragile is basically antifragile means something that when it has pressure applied to it, it grows, it gains strength. Mm-hmm. And so an example is if you get a vaccine, I actually spent some time living with indigenous people in the Amazon jungle, and I had to get a yellow fever shot before I went. If you get a vaccine in that sort of situation, you're getting a small dose, which then, if I'm exposed to yellow fever, I'm protected. I didn't mm-hmm. get a full exposure to yellow fever because that would have knocked me out. Mm-hmm. So this concept of antifragile basically means, and he talks a lot about Aristotle and the golden mean, and that we think that it's 50-50. The point he actually makes is that it's the golden mean may not actually be 50-50. It could be even as much as 90-10. But when you have a little bit of one and then a small dose, and it can be enough to balance things to make a system that when it comes under pressure, strong. Mm-hmm. And my firm belief is that exactly what you're saying within academia, because we've limited the right and the men's voice is missing from this stuff, that there in fact is a lot of weakness in the system because of this. It's become really fragilized.
Absolutely. Anytime that, the very essence of what a university is supposed to be about is open dialogue. The very essence of what a democracy is supposed to be about is open dialogue. The very essence of what nature is about, we see that children are raised best when there's a significant amount of father and a significant amount of mother. It's almost like nature created this checks and balances between father and mother. And just like there's checks and balances in the United States between Republicans and Democrats, the Republicans hate the Democrats and vice versa.
Right.
But we all sense on some level that we have a better nation as a result of the checks and balances, not only between parties, but between branches of government. And the university has lost checks and balances in the gender dialogue. There is no gender dialogue.
Right.
It's women's studies and gender studies classes, which are theoretically open to both genders, have the only discussions of men are within the framework of the conditions of the feminist movement. And so we have a gender monologue, and that's extremely dangerous because it's not only in the universities where it exists, it also exists in the divorce courts. So children who most judges and most people agree that children after divorce are best are best raised by both parents, but that's the starting assumption. But when a mom objects to that father being involved, it takes him $100,000 to $150,000 or more in money to fight her resistance to his involvement. And when that means that father involvement, when a mother resists after divorce, is confined to only the wealthy dads. And that's a huge mistake that we're making, because particularly in poor areas, children need their fathers. But in all socioeconomic brackets, when especially after divorce, children need both their mothers and their fathers. And so that type of carryover from the assumptions of feminism that on the one hand, both sexes should be able to do anything, and on the other hand, if there's a conflict between the sexes and the mother doesn't want the father involved, then we give the mother the advantage, and the father has to prove himself innocent as opposed to being assumed an equal participant.
So I'll ask one of the controversial questions, not that there's many in gender issues. since the rise of second wave feminism, we have a lot of school shootings. Do you see a correlation?
No, probably the things that I see are the biggest contributors to school shootings are, first, boys. Every school shooting, serial killing, except for one since the 80s, has been involved boys. So people often talk about it. Is it gun control? Is it mental health? Is it media, violence in the media? Is it feminism? But, our daughters and our sons are both exposed to the same amount of, feminist influence, probably our daughters more so. Our daughters and sons both either do or don't have guns in their home. Our daughters and sons both have mental health issues, and yet it's our sons that are doing the killing. So the real question that needs to be asked, that yes, feminism is guilty of repressing the discussion on this, is what is happening to our boys today? Why is this the first time in U.S. history and in the history of most industrialized nations that boys will have less education in the United States than their fathers for the first time in American history? Why is it that boys' IQs are reducing, 15 points lower than they used to be? Why is it that, in every area, why is it in math and science, girls and boys are now, even when they used to be, boys used to be way ahead, but in reading and writing, boys have always been a little bit behind. Now they're way behind. This is not just in the United States, but in Canada and most all the industrialized countries
just,
that I've examined.
Just to circle back to this question, so on the shootings, you don't feel that there's a relationship. You think that that's something unrelated?
Well, I don't see a relationship directly, except in so. I, well, the part
so,
of
okay, so these are indirect influences that you think of.
Yes, I know where the greatest relationship is. is the lack of attention to boys in the culture and what's happening with boys. I think that, you know, the opposition to gun control. I don't think there should be gun control. I think there should be gun elimination, and that we should, you know. And I have when I ran for governor of California, I outlined a very in-depth program as to how we could move toward gun elimination. The country that's done moved a little bit in that direction, that has had extreme success, as far as I know, in terms of inhibiting serial killings, is Australia, where you're from. And so, and yet the right here and the National Rifle Association is extremely closed-minded to an open discussion on that issue, in the same way that the academia tends to be an extremely closed-minded to an open discussion on gender. So I see that as being an important ingredient as well.
Okay.
So you can see, you know, you can see now, Adrian, why the left hates me and the right hates me.
I get it. It can happen. Now, so something that's very interesting to me is two things. Can you talk about what was it like to work with Betty Friedan and Gloria Steinem and these people? Now, one of the things that we get from feminism is that, you know, we must have empathy. I get the impression that these people were not particularly easy people to get along with.
Well, let's see. They're on a scale of 1 to 10. I'd say Betty is a somewhere between a 0 and a 1 in terms of negative, with 0 being the least easy to get along with. And Gloria was somewhere between a 9.5 and a 10. Gloria is an extraordinarily generous woman toward both women and men, even though her political views are far more rigid than Betty Friedan's were. Betty put women almost every place I would speak at around the country when I was in feminist mode, and therefore being supported by feminists to speak everywhere. Very frequently, I would arrive at a campus after Betty Friedan had arrived, you know, 6 months or a year before, and almost invariably, when she had spoken there previously, some woman who, like, picked me up would, you know, from the airport, would say some version of, you know, when Betty was here, she was picked up from the airport by so-and-so, who was a great fan of Betty's. And Betty would just say, you know, things like, shut up and carry my bags, you know, and just put her down as a person and treat her like a servant. And any type of real dialogue with Betty, she was very condescending toward other women, less condescending, but still so toward other men, unless somebody was at her status level or close to it or could do her some good. She was an extremely condescending person. And most people knew this about her. When I was on the board of NOW in New York City, we were sitting around, and somebody came in and put up a notice in our room, and somebody said, what's the notice? And they said, oh, Betty Friedan needs a new assistant. And one of the women at our table said, excuse me, but I think that's a repeat notice, because she just, that was up there a couple of weeks ago. She's gotten a new assistant from, since then. And she said, yes, but she's lost that assistant. And the woman says, what happened? Why was that assistant so irresponsible? And the woman said, I'm afraid it's not the assistant that's irresponsible. Betty keeps putting women down that are working for her, and they end up being extremely upset, and they end up quitting, even though they're her hero, when she joins them. And that's sort of a summary of Betty Friedan. On the other hand, Gloria was exactly the opposite of that. She was very acknowledging of people, brought them into conversations, made sure they weren't interrupted, was really a gem of a person.
That's interesting. So what about other leading feminists, for example, Germaine Greer? I've gotten the impression that a lot of the leading feminists were more like Betty Friedan than they were a little bit difficult to get along with. Is that accurate?
Well, Germaine, that is depending on how you look at it. Germaine was a spark plug. A phenomenal intellectual, and really a narcissist, and therefore, as all narcissists are, difficult to get along with. But she was also extremely entertaining, and she did have listening skills. They were, you know, they were not as good as Gloria's, but certainly not as bad as Betty's. And she was funny and self-effacing, and care a lot about Germaine Greer. So all of those were, I think, true, and probably, yeah, with all three of these things that I'm saying, almost everyone, I am not saying anything that 90% of people that have had long-term experiences with all three of these women would probably disagree with.
And in general, do the feminists that really changed things like Betty did, were they tended to be more like Betty?
I'd say most of the feminists had a number of characteristics in common. They were very bright. They tended to have a bit of an academic orientation, very well read. Many of them, they divided between academics and activists, but the early ones were more activists. And they were, yes, they were tough to get along with. They, in those days, we have to remember that women there was a much greater expectation on women to sort of, you know, agree and go along and get along. And they were really, they were definitely not in that mode. They were challenging that. So the progress of women is largely dependent upon the personalities of that. We have to remember that all radicals in all movements that I'm aware of tend to be unhealthy people who create healthy changes. The changes are healthy because they filter through balanced people that are more balanced. They get argued out, you know, 30, 40 years from now, you know, there is going to be more attention to boys and men's issues and, you know, the gender unbalance that has happened in the last years will be more balanced. And, you know, part of what a democracy is about is that things go, you know, it's like an airplane. It keeps adjusting to an out of balance situation. And so you never can have a movement where it's of any type whatsoever, where the leaders are not as individuals out of balance. In order to make things happen, you have to devote enormous numbers of hours of the week and your life to making that happen. And people who do that usually have personal issues.
Sounds like you're describing me. let's move on.
That's cute. You're describing me. Let's move on. Right? I like that.
So you converted. You said at some point, no more second wave feminism. Something's changed. When did that happen, and why did that happen?
Yes. Excuse me for a second. I don't see myself as having converted primarily. I think that I've always was in favor of both sexes having more expanded roles. I thought feminism was in favor of that. At the beginning of the feminist movement, Gloria Steinem was very articulate about the issue of women needing, women and boys and girls needing more father and less mother. So the belief that Gloria supported more flexibility in the male role, playing more involvement as a dad, and that as well as more flexibility in the female role, that seemed to me to be part of what feminism was about. But as I developed, two things happened. One was a change in me. One was a change in feminism. The change in feminism was that it became more about of women, by women, for women. But especially for women, the National Organization for Women is the National Organization for Women. Men can be involved as long as they focus on women's issues, and that's fine enough. Any group that advocates tends to have a position that they're advocating. But what my initial expectation was this was going to be the beginning of social change that would be better for both sexes, and it has not been better for boys and men. And also at the beginning, I believe that men did earn more money than women did for the same work. I believe that men did have the power. What I came to understand as I did the research for The Myth of Male Power and then a book on the gender pay gap called Why Men Earn More was that neither of those was true in the deeper sense of the word. When I say the deeper sense of the word, when I say male power is a myth, I don't mean that I'm denying that men have more institutional power. Obviously, they do. But if you redefine power as control over one's life, then men throughout all of history did not have control over their life. The common denominator of all heroes, as Joseph Campbell used to say in Hero with a Thousand Faces, that the common denominator of all heroes and all societies that survived was training their sons to be disposable. Disposable in war, disposable as heroes, disposable in coal mines, disposable in construction sites. We still are not questioning that propensity for male disposability today. And so the...
Sorry, just before we go on, just to keep this on your conversion, can you maybe go into that a little bit more? Because this is kind of a big deal for me.
Yes, this is where I changed in relation to what I understood when I was deeply involved with feminism. I understand now that neither sex had power historically if you define power as control over your own life. Both sexes had roles. Both of those roles were rigid. We didn't have a patriarchy that created rules to benefit men at the expense of women, which is what all women's studies courses say is the truth. We had rather, the dominating force was not men or women, it was the need to survive. And to survive, our dads sacrificed their lives as, you know, whether it was if they were Chinese, it might have been working on the railroad in the United States and dying left and right so that they could bring pay for the transportation to bring their children and their wife to a better world. And when they spent 7 years doing that for themselves, they spent another 7 years of indentured servitude doing that for their wife, and then more time doing that for their children. Because every group that fathers and mothers had in common the same thing. They were willing to sacrifice significant aspects of their life so that their children would have a better life and have less sacrifice than they needed to have. That was the distinction between slavery and non-slavery. Was the only group of people that didn't have that were slaves, who were told that if you sacrificed and worked hard, the plantation owner would earn more. You wouldn't make the life of your children any better.
And so, what was the pivotal thing that caused you to change your mind, and how old were you when that happened? I mean, did it happen as you reached the standard age where if you're, you know, below a certain age, you're left wing, and then if you're older than a certain age, you're right wing?
No, because I became both more left wing and more right wing. I'm always resisting what I think doesn't make sense for people growing in the culture. I began to see my resistance to some of the orthodox politically correct feminism occurred as feminism went from a open discussion, which it really wasn't very much of, but gender dialogue was open at the very beginning with people like the BEMS. You know, they were talking about, you know, how much is nature, how much is nurture, how much can we change? That was the dialogue at the very beginning. But as feminism became a strong bureaucratic force, it became rigidified and solidified. And I started seeing that as an example in my personal life. When, as always, I was being invited by feminist sponsoring groups to various organizations around campus, and this is really a perfect example. So my attitude was, I want women and men to understand each other. So I would give speeches and get standing ovations, and people would say, you know, you're wonderful, Warren. But I said, wait a minute, the purpose of these talks is not to say I'm wonderful. It's to get you to sort of experience emotionally something different. So I then developed these men's beauty contests and role reversal dates. And I said, basically, every woman is part of a beauty contest every day of her life. So I would like every man who came here to learn about women to come up on stage and be part of this beauty contest of everyday life and experience what women go through when they're looked at primarily as sex objects. And so all the men would go through the beauty contest, usually 98% to 100% of the men. and the audience would agree to do this. And the feminists loved it. They were cheering me, and like I was the hero, because I was getting the men to understand what women were going through. I was getting the men to walk a mile in women's moccasins. And years later, sometimes decades later, I would meet somebody somewhere that had been through those beauty contests, and they would remember that experience. Now, then I said, but the job here is to walk a mile in each other's moccasins. Therefore, I'm going to ask all the women who are earning more money or expect to have careers that will be earning more money, because many of these were in college, to be sitting in the first rows, and women who are earning less money to be sitting in the second rows, third rows, fourth rows, and so on. And the women who are going to be earning nothing in X number of years, or who are adults here who are earning nothing now, you'll be sitting in the back rows. And then I'm going to ask the women to risk rejection by asking the men that they're most interested out on a role reversal date, where your job will be to get as far as you can with the men, and the guys, your job is going to be to be very slow, to be very cautious in the process.
So how does that go?
And the feminists just left. Not the feminists, the leading feminists who sponsored me, the bureaucratized women's studies feminists, left in droves. Now, these were women for whom I was a mini god, insofar as a man could be a god within the framework of the feminist movement. I had the greatest amount of respect probably of any single male in the world on the issues of feminism. But yet they were leaving me the moment I asked them to risk rejection by asking a man out, and therefore walking a mile in a man's moccasins and experiencing what I called the up to 150 risks of rejection that men often take between eye contact and intercourse. And so I began to see that feminism was a one-way street, that its job, and that's what made me change
I'm going to have to speed up because we're actually running out of time, and I've got about another 40 minutes worth of questions to ask you.
Sure.
How old were you when you changed?
This was a very evolutionary experience. It was somewhere between, probably between very gradually between mid-70s and mid-80s.
Okay. So one of the things I'm curious about is something that's very popular today is the game or social dynamics that guys are learning. What are your thoughts on that?
Give me some examples so you can, so I'm making sure I tap into the same part of that game as you're talking about.
There's a book by Neil Strauss called The Game, which teaches how to pick up women.
Right. Well, all right. I think it's most things that I've seen in this, I have not seen Strauss's The Game, are oriented to the act of being more successful in picking up and mostly manipulated devices. And on the opposite side of what I would presume the game is suggesting is books some years ago, like The Rules. And they were teaching women how to, get men. I've very rarely seen those books that have values that I share.
Okay, so I'm gonna keep moving through these because I just want to try and get through the rest of this if that's okay. And I'm sorry.
No problem.
One of the things that you see discussed in the men's rights movement is the fall of Rome, and I'm curious as to your thoughts on that. One of the things that I noticed looking at there was a book written in 1776 that was sort of the original thing, the decline of the Roman Empire. That was very much used by the founding fathers of the United States. And one of the things that that book apparently talks about is how the Romans became quite effeminate and unable to defend themselves.
Well, it is true that throughout all of history, when there is a lot of luxury, or as in the Tokugawa period in Japan a few hundred years ago, when there is a long period of peace, when there are long periods of peace, or when there's a lot of luxury, people no longer have to train their sons in peace to be disposable in war. And so therefore, when boys don't have to be artificially trained to be disposable, they are able to enjoy their life. They're able to choose to do what they want to do. And then when you give people freedom to be who they want to be, rather than being told that they have to, the only way that they can be considered a man is to be a worrier and be disposable or be a coal miner or, you know, support your family and never do anything you want to do in your life, because being a man is not doing about what you want to do, it's doing about is being responsible. That's good for often the next generation. It just isn't oftentimes that healthy for the individual human being who dies in war or dies in a coal mine or spends his whole life like the character in Sinclair Lewis's Babbitt, never having done anything he wants to do one day in his life. And so, yes, you're going to have people, when people are free, two things will happen. One thing that will happen is that they'll be free to be lethargic, effeminate, sort of only effeminate, and not be in touch with the best parts of masculinity. The other thing that will happen is you have people free to make choices to be creative and at the top of their game in a much more creative type of way than many conservatives are comfortable with. And so you have both things happen. You have genius flourish. You have men doing things that that in design or in art that they wouldn't be able to do if they were brought up as a real man, and you have women being able to do things that they would never have done if they were told that the only thing they could be is a secretary, teacher, or mother.
So, are there parallels between what was written about in 1776 and becoming very effeminate, and the fall of Rome, and what we're seeing today?
There are always parallels between all successful cultures and other cultures that follow in history, and that's why it's important for us to take away lessons from that. And there are also things that and China will go through the same thing. You know, China's making enormous progress on, you know, urbanizing and so on, but they'll soon deal with questions of pollution and questions of values and questions of is it ethical to steal other people's intellectual property and so on. We evolve for both better and worse. We evolve to a deeper sense of ethics, sensitivity, inclusivity, and morality as we are an advanced culture, and we also an openness and tolerance, and we also tend to get more lazy and lethargic and not be concerned about dominating the world as much.
Okay. We're just about out of time. Is there anything that you would like to bring up which we haven't discussed?
Yeah, I'd say when I thought about meat innovators, one of the questions that I was thinking about addressing was thinking that you might ask something like, what is the most important innovation that we could have for the future? And if I were to answer that question, I'd say it's training boys and girls to communicate with each other at a very early age. That communication training should be part of our school system. Now, we've made a huge leap forward in communication skills with active listening, but what no one is doing anywhere in the world that I'm aware of is training people who are criticized to be able to go away from, to escape our normal biological patterning of responding to criticism by becoming defensive. So historically and biologically, when we were criticized, like by another kinship network or another tribe, we feared that that might mean that they were the enemy. And therefore, we would get up our defenses, or we would kill the enemy before the enemy killed us. And so therefore, our inheritance is to be extraordinarily sensitive to any form of personal criticism, particularly from a loved one, where we feel most vulnerable. And so we tend to respond to that criticism by becoming defensive. And while that was very useful for survival, it is very dysfunctional for love, because when we are criticized, what the person criticized needs is to feel that we are there supporting what their feelings are and what their fears are and what their and we're first able to listen to them. When a person criticizing us does feel listened to, they feel more loved by us. When they feel more loved by us, they feel more love for us. But our brains do not associate personal criticism from loved ones with an opportunity for love, or what I call a love guarantee. So part of the work that I do with men and women now is to realize that real innovation for the future is not just about the substance of male and female issues. It is about getting men and women, parents and children, Israelis and Palestinians, everyone who disagrees, to really hear each other and to not do the normal when attacked, is to distort with the words of the attacker and then to sidestep the attack and counterattack. And that, I think, would be the greatest innovation and a mother of all innovations, if we can bring that about in the next generation.
Excellent. Well, Warren, thank you very much for doing the call.
You're very welcome. It's a real pleasure talking with you.
Thank you.